Benjamin Gottlieb here in the studio with our engineer, Matt Schwartz, who just reminded me we have a YouTube channel for Shopify Masters. So if you'd like to watch this episode instead of just listening to it, head over to YouTube or the YouTube app and search for Shopify Masters. And also, thank you so much for your continued support.
Hailey Bieber talked about us organically, which I almost fell down. I was like, how did this happen?
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. I'm Shuang Esther Shan. Ever wish your makeup could look great while feeling great on your skin? Meet Amy Liu, founder of Tower 28. She's worked over 20 years in the beauty industry, battling her own eczema before saying enough is enough.
We're the only beauty brand that is 100% compliant with the National Eczema Association.
In just 5 years, Amy turned Tower 28 into a multi-million dollar phenomenon by doing what beauty giants said couldn't be done. Produce clean, sensitive, skin-friendly makeup that actually works, feels luxurious, while bringing great value to customers.
Why not me? Why shouldn't I go and try to do this?
So excited to have Amy here to share how she's able to build an inclusive beauty brand, land on the shelves of Sephora, and go viral on social media. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So grateful to have you here. It's so impressive, the career you've had in beauty, working for some legendary brands like L'Oreal, Kate Somerville, and it's often hard to carve out your own path. So talk to us about that journey where you always felt like you were great working for other brands, but you also had this idea of your own as well.
Yeah. So I, like you said, I've worked in the beauty industry for a really long time, and I always also wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I grew up with my dad who immigrated to America, and he was an entrepreneur, but he would have said if he was here that he did it because he had to. So English was the second language. What he felt was the opportunity to really rise up the ranks in a traditional way, he had to kind of make his own job. And he actually really encouraged me not to become an entrepreneur. I went to business school and I majored in entrepreneurship. But coming out of that, I think, again, with the combination of maybe my dad telling me don't do it, and then also at the same time, I think I felt really afraid. I felt really nervous. I grew up really middle class, but it wasn't like I had a nest egg that I could invest myself with. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to make sure that I was able to take care of myself. And ultimately, obviously, I wanted to have a family too. So I have three kids today. When I started Tower 28, I was actually 40 years old. So I did it much later in my career. But when I left business school, and I think that's kind of what you're talking about, I went to go work for other people because I told myself, I'm going to learn on someone else's dime. Mm-hmm. I'm going to learn from everything they're doing. And I actually think that was a great thing for me. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing it early, but for me, it helped me build up the confidence. And I'm going to make my own mistakes, but I feel like as a result of that, I'm trying to at least not make the same mistakes that I saw.
And I feel like it builds such a solid foundation for you. But you did mention before how you felt like, you know, I'm such a great number two. I know how to compliment founders. How do you shift from, oh, I'm a great number two, but now I have to essentially lead a brand into existence?
Yeah, it's funny. I think I had both this strange combination of like fear and hubris. Mm-hmm. So hubris in the sense that I had worked in the industry for a long time. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, I know what to do. And then I think I quickly realized to be the CEO and founder is really different than being a number two. I think when you're close to something, it almost takes away some of the scariness of it. And the founders I worked with were all really smart, but it made me realize they're not necessarily so much smarter than me. They're just smarter in different ways than I am. And it made me feel like, well, why not me? Why shouldn't I go and try to do this? I think other people build up confidence in different ways, but that was a huge part of it for me. And I think being close to it and having like a seat at the table made me think a lot about like, what would I do when I was in that position? And I think so much of the way that I manage and I lead is based on that today.
I love the fact that you almost spoke Tower 28 into existence because you always had this idea where you wanted makeup to feel great on your skin. It's good for eczema-prone skin.
Yeah.
So in the pre-launch process, what were you doing to prep yourself for launching the brand?
When I talk to young entrepreneurs a lot about advice, I think one of the things that I always try to say is just to tell everybody what your dream is, because mm-hmm. I actually really do believe in that idea of like speaking something into existence and that the universe will kind of help you in whatever way it does. For me specifically, I would say when I was in business school, nobody else wanted to work in beauty. I really wanted to work in beauty. And I told everybody like, that I wanted to work in beauty. And so every time an opportunity came in that was even remotely related to beauty, people would immediately turn it to me because they'd be like, well, I know somebody who wants to do this. And I told everybody that I also wanted to start a business. And when I finally went to go raise money and I turned to people, so many people came to me and said, hey, I know you've been wanting to do this. I've been waiting for you. You've been saying this forever. Finally, like, let me invest. And that was a huge vote of confidence for me. But I think it's also people can't help you unless you tell them that you need help and you don't, and you tell them what you're trying to do. And it's scary sometimes to let a dream out because you feel like there's so much fear in it. Yeah. Sometimes I think people fear putting their ideas out there because they're afraid to be copied. That was never really my concern, but I do think a lot of people feel that way. Ideas are a dime a dozen in my mind. It's like all in the execution.
Totally. Yeah.
And so like to me, I'm like, if you want to do something, I think like put it out into the universe and have people tell you, hey, let me connect you to this person. Let me help you in this way. But at the same time, you have to be mindful and like filter a little bit, because if you tell people what you want to do, you have to be ready for them to say that it's not good or it's stupid or you should do something different. And there's this balance between listening, which I think everybody should listen. But yeah. At the same time, you need to then think about, like, if you just do what everyone tells you to do, you'll never find your lane. And I think for me, it was really helpful for me to put it out there because people were willing to help me, whether it was fundraising, connecting me to other people in my network, in their networks. My brother is an architect and arguably really good at design and all of those types of things. And I remember showing him my logo really early days. And he was like, this is so ugly. This is so bad. And by the way, it's the same logo. And he's like, please don't launch with this. And I remember like, it really hurt, like it hurt my feelings, but I also thought about it. And I was like, should I just change it? Go back to the drawing board. But then I thought, he's like a man who doesn't use beauty products.
Yeah, I was going to say.
He's not my customer.
He doesn't get it. The beauty girlies on TikTok love it. Yeah.
So, I mean, so don't listen to your brother. he has his own merits. But like, I guess I'm just saying like you have to have some conviction, but then also be willing to listen.
You got to like seek feedback, but be critical and understanding and confident in what you want to absorb as feedback.
Yeah, because otherwise you will zig and zag too much. You can't please everybody. Mm-hmm. And you have to at your core know who you are, but then also be willing to pivot, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you put something into the world and the customer doesn't jive with it, like you're not finding that product market fit, you also have to be willing to listen.
Well, I think the concept for Tower 28 is so powerful because a lot of people right now, especially like they care about skincare, they wish products like this existed. So when you were in the early stages of formulating, figuring out partners, what is your advice there when you're starting out and you're trying to formulate differently?
I think you have to have something about what you're doing that is really unique and that people resonate with. I really believe in the problem solution concept. I remember I had a professor once who told me, don't sell a vitamin, sell a painkiller. And the idea is that like vitamins are nice to haves, right? Like you can go a day and like skip your vitamin, but like if you need an Advil, you need an Advil. Like that really makes a difference for you. And so if you can solve a problem, that's what you should try to do. What I tried to do is to solve my own problem. Mm-hmm. So I've had eczema my entire adult life. I've worked in the beauty industry. I was always the person who was going to Sephora, Nordstrom, Neiman's, and bringing them the next innovation in like foundation or skincare and saying like, hey, this is going to make your skin look perfect and aspirational. But yet, I was like, don't look at my skin, because I would get eczema on my face and I would get it on my hands. And I was just really self-conscious of it. Eczema, they say, has no cure and no cause, which is really frustrating, right? But then if those two things are true, fine. But then I also just want to cover it up to make my skin look better. And I was working, and I have worked in beauty for so long that I wanted really good products. And when I went to go cover up my skin, I felt like I was so nervous that it was making my skin worse, and it was just perpetuating my problem, because products that are high performance before were not necessarily clean. Mm. They had a lot of things in there that potentially could be bad for your skin. And they say that what you put on your skin goes into your, they say 70% of what you put on your skin goes into your bloodstream. I don't know if that's true, but if that's on a good skin barrier, I feel like when you have eczema, acne, anything where your skin barrier is compromised, then everything's kind of going into your skin. And so you should just be more careful about what you're putting on it. So I wanted products that were clean. And then I also wanted products that were safe for sensitive skin. So given that I have eczema, like that was something that was really important to me. But I also didn't want them to be, I don't know, boring and clinical.
Yeah.
And I also wanted them to be really high performance. And then the last part is like accessibly priced. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that means I still want to shop at Sephora. I still want to go to Goop and these high-end retailers. But then I also want to pay $16 for a lip gloss instead of $30.
It's so great to hear how the concept for Tower 28 grew from a personal need, and it definitely required so much testing and iterating. What kind of protocols were you following?
Yeah, so, and this goes back to your other question about how do you make sure you have like a unique selling proposition, or what kind of your brand promises, especially in, and I would almost argue that I think every industry is pretty crowded now. Mm-hmm. Beauty is incredibly, incredibly crowded right now. So I think people, again, it needs to be unique and people need to resonate with it. And so for me, the testing part of it was really the, it has to be the brand promise. Like, what is it that we're offering to the consumer? But then what is the reason to believe that you did it? And for us, so much of that is the National Eczema Association. So the National Eczema Association is a nonprofit organization that has a seal of acceptance. To be compliant with their seal of acceptance, it's three different steps. It's avoid. Mm-hmm. You avoid all of the ingredients that they consider to be irritating. Then you have to test. And so for that, we have to test 100 people that have eczema. Oh, wow. And that have sensitive skin, and then they put it on their skin for a duration of time. RAPT is where you could put on a patch. We do the next level of it, which is called safety in use, where you have to put it on your entire face.
Wow.
If it's a moisturizer, I'm putting it on my entire face. If it's a product that maybe, I don't know, say it's a brow product, I'm using it the way it was meant to be used, right? Mm. And in the amount it was meant to be used. We also do something called cumulative irritation tests, which means then I'm also doing that same thing, but I'm doing over and over and over again for a duration of time, 30 days, day and night, the way that the directions say. And then I'm not even just saying like, hey, 100 people, how did that work for you? So it's not a consumer test. It's a dermatologist is reviewing the results and saying, okay, that's not irritated skin.
Wow.
And then it goes to their third-party toxicologist, dermatologist. Like, they have a whole board that reviews everything. So they look at the ingredients, they look at the testing, they look at the product itself, and then they decide whether or not they're going to give you the seal of acceptance. We're the only beauty brand that is 100% compliant with the National Eczema Association.
Amazing.
And so that is a deep amount. And to me, that was important because I don't know, there's other brands that I've seen just as a consumer and a person in the industry that say like, hey, we're like, they claim things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one thing. But how can I believe it? What is the credible thing? And like, the truth is, I'm not a dermatologist. I'm not a toxicologist. Like, you shouldn't believe me if I just say, this is safe for sensitive skin. Mm-hmm. I believe in like third-party verification. So I believe like, we're clean at Sephora, we're clean at Credo. I'm not spending all day thinking about what the next ingredient is that's going to be an endocrine disruptor. Like, that's just not my skill set, but somebody else is. So I lean into those people. So I think all of that just to say, and for anyone out there who's developing a product, like, think about how it's not just your promise, but how is it credible?
Yeah. And it's such a intensive protocol that you followed, but yeah. I think it builds so much trust with your customers as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, and now, honestly, so I just joined the board of directors of the National Eczema Association.
Oh my goodness.
And which is so meaningful to me too. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, again, back to like the brand promise, like if you can find something that you really care about, I think for me, it happens to be eczema, but that's really kind of a placeholder for like anyone who suffers from sensitive skin.
Yeah.
And I really feel like I can understand the plight of the person who doesn't feel great in their own skin and wants to cover it up and wants to be a little bit more careful. The thing that has kept me really excited to continue on this path is really having a purpose. And that's why I just recently joined the board, because it's the National Eczema Association does more than the seal of acceptance. They do a really great job of, yes, the seal, which I kind of lump into the education side, but they also work a lot in advocacy and research as well. And so now, like, I see where the money is going. I see what is being done for, like, non-steroidal, you know, efficacy, like, different kinds of remedies that they're working on.
Yeah, and what a beautiful full circle moment as well. And I feel like that also just highlights, like, the partnerships you have as well through this protocol process. When you were developing the formulas, how were you looking for partners when you're thinking about, like, sourcing ingredients, production, and things of that sort to, like... Yeah. really build out a network of partners?
So it's a little bit easier for me in some ways because I was coming from the same industry I'd worked in such a long time. So I was, I just in general, I believe that people earn their reputations. And the same is true whether you're talking about people you're hiring or you're talking about retail partners or you're talking about vendors. And so for vendors, I mean, so much of what you need is somebody who can scale, somebody who can act quickly, someone who will do what they say when they say they'll do it.
Yeah.
And so I did. I kind of canvassed and I asked around. But I think the other requirements to think about is, especially if you're making a physical product and you need to think about production, it's like, where is it being made? What are the MOQs? Because will they work with you when you're small? And what does that look like? But can they also look at
The scalability
and the portfolio of brands that they currently carry. Because, like, for instance, our original vendor was also working on Ilia. Mm. And I was like, well, if you can do Ilia, then you're obviously able to meet that level of scale as you are to doing mine. But, like, can we then negotiate on, like, what an MOQ might look like? In the beginning, I was making 2,000 pieces of each SKU, which, you know, now we're making much more. So you want someone that you can trust, someone you like working with. And I would ask around.
Such great advice, because I feel like, to your point, you're bringing in decades of experience into the brand. Were there something that you wanted to do differently when you were starting Tower 28 as well?
I mean, there's so many things I wanted to do differently. I think we talked a little bit about the product side was a huge part of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted the products really to be efficacious. I started the company 6 years ago. I raised money 5 years ago, almost 5 years ago we launched. And 6 years ago, I would say, like, the idea of clean beauty was really different, where it was very expensive and not very efficacious necessarily. And it was also very highly natural. And so before I started Tower 28, I worked at one of the pioneering beauty brands that was pioneering in the clean beauty space. Mm-hmm. And so what we used to do is we used to write on every box, we would write how natural it is, because that's what clean meant. We would be like 85% natural, 90% natural. And that was like a big part of it. The world evolves, right? So like now we know that clean does natural doesn't necessarily mean good for you. Like I always say, like poison ivy is clean. It doesn't mean that it's like safe for sensitive skin.
Yeah.
So that part of it, for sure, product. But I always go back to at the core of it, it's like product and people. That's really what makes a business. So the product part of it is that. The people part of it, again, I think because I had been an employee for such a long time, I think you parent in a way often that is dependent on what you got. So like you try to fix the things that you wish you had differently, and you try to keep the things that you got from your parents. I think I manage in a really similar way, and I've tried to create a culture and a business that is very similar, whether we're talking about like give back initiatives or even like, as an example, really early on, we launched in 2019. COVID came very quickly after that, and we, to my knowledge, we're the first, at least in my industry, to start doing these things that we call like retreats. And so we started bringing the team together, going to an offsite, because we had just been remote and apart from each other for so long. And we still do this. So every 6 months, we bring the entire team together, and we have gone to Palm Springs, Big Bear, Italy. Yeah.
Italy.
Wow. We didn't do Italy once. I don't know if we'll do it again, to be honest with you, because it was a lot of planning and we were smaller back then. But the idea is just to really invest in the people and in the team. Yeah. I always feel like if you take care of your team, they'll take care of your customer. But you can't do one without the other.
Yeah. You're building a cycle of positivity so that, you know, great team means great customers. And
Well, and I also like to think that, like, I mean, I say this all the time to my team too, but like you can pay someone to do their job, but you can't pay people to care. Yeah. And so I think no one has the space to be able to care if they don't feel cared for themselves. And so I think like we try to invest in like, actually tomorrow we have this leadership coach that's coming in and like going through a series of these. So we learn how to like be a high performance organization that knows how to give feedback, that can handle conflict management, that we can be stronger managers. And so we really just try to invest in the team. We have monthly lunch and learns where we have somebody from outside the industry come in. Yeah. So we have like, we've had everything from like, I don't know, Olympians to, I had a friend who had like, has done like 6 different exits, and he's an entrepreneur, like a serial entrepreneur, and like just all kinds of really interesting people who come in and tell us about their perspectives. I'm trying to make it more than just a functional job that you clock in and out of, but rather something that feels meaningful.
Totally.
To them to be part of.
Yeah, you're investing a lot in the team. And I also wanted to chat about, you know, the other side of investing is also the fact that you did fundraise when you were launching. So I feel like that's also something hard to manage when you're trying to start a company, but you're also trying to fundraise. What's your advice there when you're going through something like that?
So I feel like I had maybe the easiest time fundraising of anyone I've ever known.
Yes.
There were kind of two different types of investing that I've had to fundraise for. In the very beginning, I think I mentioned, I raised friends and family at the very beginning. I raised $500,000 totally pre-launch with nothing but my resume and a deck, and honestly a very different deck than what I ended up launching.
Wow.
I don't even think anyone really looked at the deck. I think it was very much based on just like who I am and my background was how I raised the initial 500.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds easy, but it's also your hard work over 20 years.
Correct. And thank you for saying that, because I think, you know, so often people will say to me like, oh, how does it feel to have this like overnight success? And I'm like, well,
it is not.
I feel like there's no such thing as an overnight success. I've been working in the same industry for 23 years at this point. So I don't think it's an overnight success. That said, I think I worked really hard, and I still feel like I work really hard. But then I think there are certain parts that came a little bit easier because of that. So for instance, when I did my fundraise in the beginning, I was already 40. I had 3 kids. We had a mortgage. We had opted for private school, which we then pulled the kids out of private school.
Wow.
Life is expensive in LA. I didn't buy my first house until I was 39. So we had just like bought our first house. We had just remodeled it. I was in no position to go and, I don't know, take out a huge loan. I was never the type of person who would have put like, and I listen, there's nothing wrong with it if that, it's just a risk appetite thing, but I was never someone who was going to put all of the money on my credit card and max it out and then do it again. And, you know, you hear those stories, like I started in my garage. I'm not genius in isolation. Like I don't know how to, even my process, like I'm someone who asks like, what do you think? What do you think? And like, and then I come to my own conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's a little bit different in that way. For me, I had to fundraise because I didn't have the money myself. Mm-hmm. And I also wasn't comfortable not hiring people. yeah. and like doing everything by myself, right? And so I did raise the $500,000 in the beginning. I was fortunate in that I had a friend that I went to business school who had sold his own company, and he basically offered to be my lead investor. And he was like, here are the terms. This is what I think, but don't like just accept this. Go and like walk around and see, get advice from your friends to see if this works. And so I went to other people. And I think that's another piece of advice I would give entrepreneurs is instead of asking people to invest and give you money, ask people for advice. Everybody loves to get advice. And then they will tell you, I want to invest. Or you can say, hey, do you know anyone who would be interested in this opportunity? And they will connect you to somebody else. But I think that was huge for me. And it just sort of, because I had the first money in, then it made it a lot easier to get the other things. Mm-hmm. That was my first, friends and family. Then when I raised, I did raise a minority interest through private equity at the end of last year. And at that point, and people say this all the time, and it's hard to do it, but raise when you don't need it.
Yeah.
Right? Raise before you need it. Like, it's really hard sometimes to know what's coming around the bend. I also similarly, I would say don't raise if you really don't need it. So it's like kind of this combination of terrible advice because I'm saying both things.
Yeah.
Because the best time to raise is when you don't need it. And yet, if you don't know what you're going to do with the money, I would also say don't lose control, right? Like you mm-hmm. don't want to sell off so much of your business so early that you aren't able to maintain control. So I think I was able to do it at a time when I knew what I would do with the money. I was ready to invest more in the growth of the business, whether it was the inventory, the people, the infrastructure, and I kind of understood what was happening. So we have like very real investments we have to make in terms of CapEx. So like the fixtures that you see at Sephora, we have to pay for those.
Yeah, inventory. Yeah,
and inventory, yeah. like all, and people. We moved into an office. So those are all really real things. But because I did it in a time when we had already hit a certain product market fit,
yeah.
I was able to get like the valuation I wanted. I was able to get the partner that I wanted. We kept it really tight. We only invited 5 people to kind of come in and and bid. And then I think we were done. We didn't hire a banker. We, from start to finish, I think it was 6 weeks.
Wow. That's an incredible a short period of time to go through something like that.
Super yeah. quick. And I think that my big takeaways that I hope anyone out there listens to are, I hate when I hear people sell too much too early mm-hmm. because it just changes the expectations and then you can lose control. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
So do it for the right reasons. Like I did it because I wanted what they call smart money. Like I wanted somebody on board who I really felt could help me navigate the next chapter.
Yeah.
And that's what I got. And so, but you have to do it when you have enough momentum that you also understand what you're going to do with it so that you're in control and you get to choose who that partner is.
Yeah. It's very much about the expertise you want to bring on.
Yeah.
Not just the finances. But I mean, I'm so glad to hear about the initial investment from friends and family because that allowed you to springboard and launch in a way that you wanted.
Totally. And it was also really motivating for me, yeah. right? Like I wonder, like both times I've taken money, right? Both forms of it. I think for me, it's really helpful to have I'm like a highly accountable to other people person, but I'm not like probably by myself. I'm sort of lazy. Like if you just left me, if I never had raised money, I don't know if any of this would have happened because I don't know. There's some pressure that comes which is, I think, healthy too.
I feel like I'm the same. Like I thrive in group work, which sounds really odd because I feel like students don't like group work. And I'm always like, I love working in a group. So
I think it's group, but it's also like, I'm like this is not necessarily a good thing, but you just have to know yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm someone who likes to get like a gold star. I like to understand what it's like. I was a good student, right? I'm like, tell me how to get an A. And I'll work towards that. And I think if you can get enough smart people around you who can help you understand what that looks like. And on the friends and family side, it's like, I literally vacation and go to dinner with these people. It was like, truly, it was like my best friend. It was people that I really know. And I think that helped me because I was like, I need to move the ball. You know, I think sometimes when people hear friends and family, they think that means that you just have like really wealthy friends and family. Mm-hmm. That's not really the case. And honestly, it wasn't even my family. The only family was me. I asked my dad to invest and he said no. He's like, I think it's too risky. And he's kind of right, to be honest with you. Like, yeah. It really was very risky early on. And I can understand why it hurt my feelings, but I can also understand why he said that.
After that first secured round, you were able to launch and the community really like came to the brand. So what were some strategies that really worked in different channels that allowed Tower 28 to be like finding its like cult following?
I mean, social was a huge part of it for us. And I'll like take you back a little bit. So we launched in 2019 with nothing but like an Instagram mood board. Honestly, like no one was paying attention. I still remember the first Shopify sale that we made where it was someone I didn't know. And I remember one of the girls on my team, I like screenshot it because I thought it was so funny because she sent a screenshot of the Shopify order. And she's like, it's our first order that isn't like basically my husband or like someone, it's someone we don't know. And it was so thrilling and
what
exciting.
What a great feeling. Yeah.
And I used to keep the sound on from that Shopify makes like the little cha-ching where like I would be at dinner or something and it would just like sound off. And I remember whoever it was, I was at dinner with, like, don't you think that's annoying and distracting? I'm like, no, I find it so calming. that's something. There's like passive income. Like we're not passive income, but you know what I mean? That
a steady income.
Something's happening. It felt really good. Back in 2019, we launched without much fanfare. Pre-2020, I think this was more okay. Like to receive packages from someone you didn't know was more okay for some reason. But we would literally just go through, me and the girls on my team, we would go through the YouTube channels for people and they had like an info tab where they would put
a P.O. box.
They would put addresses and literally we just would scrub these and like write these lists together and it was based on like who they followed, who I followed, whatever. And we just cold scent products. And honestly, this was back in the day when maybe you remember that people were sending like full, like life-size beauty blenders and like really like iPads built into the boxes, like very ornate and like glamorous PR boxes. I was not doing that. I was sending a little PR box with inside of a craft mailer that was decorated, but it was like very small with the product in it with some shred inside. I mean, like literally everything we ordered from like Uline, like nothing exciting. But from the very beginning, I've always really believed in a handwritten note. And so I would write them, the girls on my team would write them, and we would say like, well, okay, you put that person's name on the list. Like, why did you put it on the list? And I would write to Chriselle Lim. I'd be like, Chriselle, I think you would love this product because your daughters or whatever it is. And I know you're a mom and you're busy. So I think that you'll love this because et cetera. And we would just send these packages out to people. And there was this like, honestly, not all of them, right? So our open rates were certainly not 100%, but there were a few. And I think in the beginning, those moments where social is free. The other thing that really made a big difference for us was we went into retail pretty quickly. And so I think especially as somebody who doesn't have a platform of influence that I own, like I'm not a celebrity, but I do have retailer relationships because of my experience. And so we were able to go into Credo really quickly, which is a clean beauty retailer. And then we went into Sephora. So we launched in April of 2019. We were on Sephora.com by September. By March of 2020, we went into all stores at Sephora with a half shelf, which was like, I mean, I was floored. I was so, like, that doesn't happen. I don't know if most people know this, but even like when Lady Gaga launches at Sephora, they did not go into all stores. They went into, I don't know what
select
they did,
stores.
But select, like only like a, I think maybe a Glossier went into all stores, something that was already really proven, something like that. It doesn't happen very often that you can go into all stores, even on a half shelf like we did. And so we went into all stores on a half shelf. I thought I was going to spend the whole year training the stores and doing something very different. And then COVID hit. And so the thing that really helped there was we have this product called our SOS Daily Rescue Facial Spray. It's our number one selling product. It is antibacterial, antimicrobial. And we knew that it was really good for so many different reasons. For me, it's eczema. For someone else, it might be acne. Basically, any angry skin, the issue is inflammation. The thing that stokes the inflammation and makes it worse is the bacteria. Mm-hmm. So if you can kind of manage both of those things at the same time, you can almost like eliminate or get rid of or at least maintain your issue. What happened is when COVID hit, we saw all these people were wearing masks, especially essential workers, right? Because they're like out in the world. They're wearing masks and they're talking and you're still eating at the same time. So people were getting maskne for the first time in their lives.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I didn't know this until we saw the community. So I think social listening is also really important. We saw people saying like, hey, this spray is really changing my skin. I'm spraying it like in between. And we were like, huh, okay. And I'm at home. So I'm like, well, why don't we just, at first it was like, let's just try to be helpful for like essential workers. So we started sending it to essential workers in hospitals.
Amazing. Yeah.
And to me, it was more like there's a critical mass of them. So I would like, I asked friends, I was like, who's a doctor? Put me in touch with your ER or whoever it is. And like, give me your like charge nurse. And I would send like 50 bottles to somebody and then they would distribute it. And then someone would post it and they would say like, show me a before and an after. They would post her before and afters. And I was like, wait, this is really working. Yeah. And then I would write to them and I'd say, like, if you really love it, can I use your before and after? And I'll give you another bottle. And I was literally the one doing this myself.
Wow.
And I mean, the girls on my team were helping too. And then we would send them another bottle, but we would take their before and after because they gave us permission to use it. And we would put it on our Shopify site. And so then we had before and afters that came from the community. And then it just kind of perpetuated. And I think because normally when you're in a store setting, I don't know if general people know this, but when you go to Sephora, some of the people working there, and even if they're wearing all black, they are hired by the brands.
Yes.
So they're not necessarily Sephora employees. And a lot of the big companies spend a lot of money on this. And so it's actually sometimes it's hard to be in that environment if you're not spending that money. I think because of COVID, it almost like leveled the playing field.
Yeah.
Everyone was working with the same tools, social influencer, right? It was basically all digital. And so then the game was a little bit different. Like, yes, you can spend money on performance marketing, but, and I always say this to my team, like you can, somebody can outspend us, but can we out-clever them? Is there a way that we can just be more thoughtful about what we're putting out there? And that's kind of what happened. We had like the right product at the right time. And I think like great marketing is a short-term solution. Great product is a long-term thing. So like, I really do believe that like we have great product. And I think there just also became more of awareness around like sensitive skin and what we're putting on our skin and what we're eating. So I think all of those contributed to our growth.
It sounds like for the social community, the social love, all the viral moments, you really built them interaction by interaction.
Yeah.
And it all kind of ties back to the fact that the product speaks for itself and people truly love it and you interact with the community in such thoughtful ways.
The real trick is how do you do that and then scale it, right?
Yeah.
So for instance, right, the before and after example is a good one of like that was an individual interaction.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think the magic happens when I can take that before and after and I can share it with the rest of the world or when I can, like Hailey Bieber talked about us organically, which I almost fell down. I was like, how did this happen? Like so many people started texting me.
Yeah.
I didn't know her. I didn't know that she knew who we were, nothing.
Yeah.
And she had just launched Rode and she posted on her stories and on TikTok, I've been trying all of these lab samples and it's making my skin really irritated. Here's what I'm using to keep my skin at bay.
Wow.
And she posted a picture of herself with, let's be honest, mildly irritated skin.
Still beautiful skin.
Because she's just so pretty. I don't know, whatever. And then after that, she just posted a picture like from the P page of her product and said that's what she was using. And it could have been just that. But I think for the marketers out there, I think the thing that you really need to do, one, you have to think, right? So like I don't even know if she ever got it, but I sent her, I think, like an $800 bouquet of flowers because I didn't know what else to send her.
Yeah.
But then after that, editors wanted to write stories about it.
Amazing. Yeah.
And so then you're like, they're asking you questions about it. And then you have to like be there to actually feed those stories and be like, okay, well, here is what, you know, hypochlorous acid is, and this is why our product's so great, and here are some before and afters. And so, like, to take anything and then amplify it, I think that's really the trick. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we were able to, like, stitch content on top of what Haley did to say, like, oh my God, we're so excited this happened even, yeah. you know, just to, like, even say thank you. And obviously you want to make sure you're being very respectful of a creator when they do something like that and ask for permission. But when you get those kind of early moments, it's about the amplification around it. Like, remember, really, again, back to me, like, wanting gold stars and being a good student. I remember really early on, I had a friend, a mentor, who was a super successful tech founder. And I said, okay, well, how do I know I'm doing a good job? Like, what are my KPIs? What should I be paying attention to? And I thought he was going to say, like, this is what your CAC should be, and this is what your LTV should be, and this is what your AOV should be. And he was like, honestly, throw all of that out the window. He's like, you just need to pay attention in the beginning to momentum. Yeah. Like, you need to be able to feel it, to feel like this is working, because it is so hard to continue investing, not just the money, but, like, your energy, your time into it. And everybody will feel it. If you don't believe in this, like, your retailer partner will feel it, your employees will feel it, your customer will feel it. Like, nothing matters more than your own belief. And the thing that will give you the reason to continue believing is the momentum and feeling like you're actually solving someone's problem. So I do think that's what the focus should be on.
Totally, totally. That just creating that cycle of positivity for yourself as well. Yeah.
Listen, I find going to, like, personal appearances, for instance, like, as somebody who's never been interested in being, like, famous. Like, I am not one of, clearly I'm not a founder who named it. This is not Amy Lou Cosmetics, right? Like, I never, as a number two, I never thought that that was something I wanted or would be. And I think beauty didn't used to be like that. Like, back in the day, like, who knows what Estee Lauder looks like? Nobody knows what Estee Lauder looks like. Clinique, yeah. Nobody knows who that founder is. And now we know who the founders are because people want to know, like, I think they vote with their wallets. And so they want to understand what they're spending their money on and what the person believes, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Personal appearances used to be really hard for me because I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And now the part of it that I really love is that, like, there's no better way to meet my customer, like, my true customer, right? Because you can read the reviews, but because so much of the world today is digital, sometimes it can feel not real. Like, even if you see the sales, even if you see the reviews, and meeting a real person who's like, this has changed my skin, or I've never been able to wear makeup until now. Like, there's nothing more gratifying. And I don't know, I think that we as founders, we need that circle, that full circle experience to keep doing it.
I'm so grateful we touched on so many aspects of the business. I do want to close off by a full circle moment, because you did mention, you know, you launched a brand when you were 40. Maybe perhaps you felt like this was later than other founders. By no means it is. But I feel like, what is your advice now for founders who are going through that mental thought process of, like, when should I start? Am I starting too early, too late? Like, what do you say to them?
So first of all, I would say statistically, in the most successful founders, they are actually much older. Or, like, when they hit success. I don't, maybe that might be indifferent of when they start, but, like, if you were to cut it that way and be like, okay, at what point they reach success. So I would say, for anyone who is thinking about starting it later in their life, I think there is so much positivity around that, and that it is really, ultimately, it's just never too late to be happy. Like, if this is something, and they always say this when you read studies about happiness, but, like, on your deathbed, nobody sits around and thinks about, like, they mostly sit around and think about what they didn't do. Like, the things that they didn't try to do or they didn't reach for. They don't really think about, like, their mistakes so much as they think about what they opted out of. And so I would say, like, if it's something that you think that you might want to do, you should try and give yourself a shot at it, because the not knowing, I think, will be harder for you later. And again, I don't know, I go back to, like, why not me? Why not you? You know, like, one thing I think I benefited from was just getting to know more of those people, because I think it becomes less scary. I did not go to an Ivy League school. Mm-hmm. And I think when I was younger, I felt really intimidated by the fact that, like, I didn't have this, like, pedigree, right? And my best friend went to Harvard. And knowing her, she's so smart. She's so capable. But, like, and then I met all of her friends. And I was like, oh, they're not, like, they're so smart and they're so capable. But I don't think they're, like, so much different. Mm-hmm. And so then it gives you a little more confidence around it where you're like, okay, like, everyone is just different in their own way. So you just have to figure out what your version of smart is. And then if you can put people around you who can compliment you, then I think, like, it's kind of unstoppable.
Yeah, I love that. Well, cheers to finding our version of smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here, Amy.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Amazing. Thank you so much for tuning in. Subscribe to Shopify Masters for new episodes every Tuesday and Thursday, and we will see you next time.